The cigarette was back out of Bryce's mouth and jammed against Buddy's face. It was accompanied by the requisite screaming and thrashing. A little bit later, done with burning Buddy for the minute, Bryce took herself another long drag of the cig, not caring that it was more than getting to be severely mangled.
Wrong answer. Look, they found your bud's body, your car. You two boys were a couple of dumbasses. And from where I sit,
she bounced on Buddy's lap.
You're not getting any smarter. Now here's the situation. I'm a single girl with a lot of time on my hands, a whole pack of cigarettes, and I only have eyes for you. So let's get down to some serious Q&A.
Of its own accord, per a long disremembered survival instinct, Buddy's bowels slackened. Fecal matter flowed free from his colon, squishing out beneath him and atomizing between his ass cheeks and the floor into a stench. It was the smell of fear. Bryce inhaled it, deeply. You could call it a break room. It was really just an extra storage room, with empties waiting to be recycled, a mop, a bucket, a broom, and other cleaning supplies used to sop up what got spilled on the 24/7 Mart floor, and a misplaced, forgotten case of Hostess products that were still as fresh as the day they were delivered, 4 years and 3 months ago. So it was really an extra storage room, but Mr. Bashir had put a chair, a radio, and a couple of small lockers in there, and called it a break room for his employees, and that was more than most 24/7 Mart managers had ever done for the people who clock punch for them. Mr. Bashir opened one of those little lockers, the one Paris used, and stood back while Marcus and Jay pawed through it. Sunglasses, a pair of socks, deodorant, a toothbrush. Either, Marcus figured, this Paris used the room to dress in, or he was prepared in case he turned out to be the one convenience store counter guy in America who ever got lucky on a job. Besides all that stuff, there were some other bits of uselessness, but there was no tape. No songs by the late Ian Germain. But there was a picture. A guy and a beautiful half-black, half-Asian woman, standing on the edge of desert, edge of city, arm in arm, before a gold-trimmed sign with blue and red letters over white backing. A famous sign, a sign Marcus has seen before. The sign said, "Welcome to fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada." Marcus showed the picture to Bashir. "This him?"
"Yes, yes, that is Paris."
Feeling guilty,
"I really should not be allowing you to look through his personal belongings."
Jay piped up excitedly, getting into his little cop act.
"I can assure you, your assistance is noted and appreciated by the United States government."
Marcus to Jay. "Shut up." Marcus to Bashir. "Can you give us his address?"
I really don't know."
Bashir was tussling with some serious inner conflict. Good citizen versus good 24/7 Mart manager.
"What is it exactly you say Paris has done?"
"That's not something you really need to know." Marcus was dagger sharp.
"But he is my employee, and a good one. If you say he has done wrong, why is it you cannot tell me what he has done wrong?"
"Mr. Bashir, right? Do you know what being an accessory to a crime means?"
I...
"Do you know what obstruction of justice is?"
"Obstruct..."
"It's kind of a tongue twister, but 15 to 25 will give you plenty of time to practice it." Sweating, goosey, good citizen versus good 24/7 Mart manager versus hard time.
"But I don't really..."
Jay just stood and listened, and watched Marcus play hardball. It was exciting. Jay felt himself get excited. By the way, Marcus wondered out loud, your immigration papers, are they all in order? Buddy's exposed flesh had become canvas for a particular kind of métier. Bryce's specialty, call it making a guy hurt every way you know how. And shirt ripped open, there was plenty of flesh for Bryce to get creative with. Most of Buddy's fine collection of wounds were of the cigarette burn variety, in an assortment of severity. The not so bad, the very bad, the horribly ulcerated. The ulcerated ones were Bryce's best work, deep depressions, the edges of the burns white and elevated like the rim of a volcano. This surrounded by cherry red and swollen skin. Those burns that had been festering a bit, and they'd a bit to fester. Bryce, closing in on one very long hour and 18 minutes of fucking Buddy up, were filling with a creamy yellow pus that bubbled up and seeped at the slightest pressure. The pressure Bryce had applied to most of them was more than slight. Buddy was bathed in an oily sheen that was continually manufactured and pumped from just beneath his skin. The others, the fresh burns, were red and black, and the only thing that ran from them was blood. The rest of Buddy was simply decorated with the usual assortment of bruises and cuts and lacerations that are normally incurred during any standard torture session. The one real unique welt was the Tim from Timberland, imprinted across Buddy's back, where Bryce had stomped him with her booted foot. Buddy was starting to remember that, the getting stomped. Buddy was starting to remember a lot of the last hour and 18 minutes. He was back now, having gone away for a little while, during Bryce's festivities. Unfortunately, not far enough away that he couldn't feel every burn, every slap, every brass-knuckle punch Bryce had given him. He unstupored to find himself alone in the living room. He wasn't alone in the house. From the kitchen came the sounds of plates, utensils, pots, and pans being tossed around. Bryce was looking for the drugs. From the way the living room had been torn up, or from what he could see of it through his eye that wasn't filled with blood and swollen clothes, it was obvious to Buddy she'd already whirlwinded through there during his absence. But if she was still looking, still searching, that meant she hadn't yet been in the bedroom, hadn't yet taken a gander in the duffel under Paris's bed. That meant Buddy hadn't told her. Despite the pain and the passing out, Buddy hadn't told Bryce where, in the very next room, he'd hidden the drugs. Buddy had to snicker at that some. Everybody had always said that even on a sunny day at high noon, he was never anything but a scared little bitch. Alfonso had told him that. Alf had told him that so many times, Buddy got it in his head he had to go help steal some smack just to prove who was what. Alf was dead. Alf was dead, and here Buddy was, still somewhat alive. More than that. Cigarette after cigarette, pack after pack, burn after deep, sizzling burn. Buddy hadn't given up anything to Bryce. Not a word. Screams, sure, lots of those. But not a word. Who's the bitch now? Buddy taunted at Alf in hell and at Bryce in the kitchen. Tried to taunt, but the blaring radio that had kept his cries of agony from being heard also prevented Bryce from hearing his little voice, which barely made it past swollen, blistered lips hanging from a bloody, bloated, repeatedly kicked face. Who's the bitch now? The door. Buddy caught a one-eyed glance of it, and his train of thought jumped to another track. The door. Right there across the room. The door to the apartment that led outside where there were people. People who could save and rescue Buddy, and help him wake from this dark dream he was living. The door. Bryce was in the kitchen, and the door was waiting. All Buddy had to do was walk to it, open it, and keep walking on through to all those glorious, ready-to-aid their badly beaten and busted fellow man, Angelinos. Except he couldn't walk. Bryce had done something to his legs. Something Buddy didn't want to look down to see exactly what, because he was pretty sure it would just make them hurt worse. But he could still crawl. Oh, yeah. Crawling was something he could do with newborn proficiency. So Buddy crawled for the door. Only it wasn't quite a crawl, but something much more feeble. It was a lot like a sea lion trying to drag itself across an acre of broken but not very ground glass. Hands crept out, then pulled the body forward. Grunts and groans and snarls went with every millimeter covered. Still in the kitchen looking for those drugs, Bryce didn't notice the crawling Buddy. And the radio that had kept Buddy from being helped now kept him from being found out. Hands crept out, then pulled the body forward. Right. I'll just get to the door and everything will be okay, Buddy's mind propagandized itself. Outside will be people. Outside will be good Samaritans and police and maybe a attack squad to take this bitch down. Outside everything is beautiful and wonderful, and there are no more cigarettes out there. Please, God, don't let there be any more cigarettes out there. Don't let there be any more cigarettes anywhere in the entire world. Hands crept out, then pulled the body forward. 3 millimeters down. 1 mile to go. He could do it. He could make it. He could. If Bryce just stayed in the kitchen another hour or so. Just another hour. The song on the radio faded, mixed into a fresh one. 70s guitar licks let it off. Before the song made it through the first few bars, from the kitchen, Bryce squealed. Into the living room she came flying. Buddy went still, like maybe being still would somehow make himself and his welts and pus sacks that he was moving for the door blend in with the rest of the room. Nothing unusual here, Bryce. Just a guy dying. Only he knew it wouldn't. Only he knew she would see him. Only she didn't. The only thing Bryce did do was go to the busted Sony, crank it, Bachman Turner Overdrive, Hey You, slammed off the walls. Bryce, little girl, excited. I love this song! And she danced, right there in the middle of the floor, between using some guy as an ashtray and scouring his pad for drugs, Bryce did a go-go bump and grind that was only missing the thigh-high Nancy Sinatras with zippers up the calves. Bryce had a way of shaking her groove thang that was serious with its hypnotic self. The whole section of her that circumferenced ass and muff was a combo aphrodisiac Venus flytrap. Most likely as many men had been killed by that is by her cigs. Her head whipped. Her body flailed to the licks. Her tits jiggled just enough to indicate their realness without giving up too much firmness. The whole package was a sight to see, if there had been anyone there to see it. There wasn't, except for Buddy. And Buddy, while Bryce was busy giving it up for tunes from fat Canadian rockers, was making double time for the door. 2 millimeters of drag now instead of 1. Hands crept out, then pulled the body forward. So very much pain. Bryce lifted her arms, twisted side to side. Her navel was exposed. A little platinum ring pierced there. Hands crept out. They bumped wood. The door. The most beautiful door in the entire history of the human race. Hand up now instead of out. One arm was all Buddy could manage the strength to operate. The hand reached, groped, fumbled at the knob. Its weakness and the blood that covered the palm made grasping an event. It reached, groped, fumbled more. Fingertips barely took hold of brass. In time to the music, Bryce moved across the room. Her hands took Buddy by the ankles. One hard yank pulled him clear of the door. His head bounced off the floor. One ear took the thud. The other heard from Bryce.
Silly rabbit! Twix are for kids!
She knew. The whole time she was dancing and gyrating and carrying on, she was hep to Buddy's grand and elaborate crawling escape plan. She let him drag himself across the room, just for the subsequent pleasure of jumping in and stubbing out what little bit of hope he had left, the same as she'd stubbed out her cigarettes on his body. She was just toying with him, playing with him. It was like... Oh yeah, Buddy reminded himself. It was like she was torturing him. Bryce towered over Buddy. He looked up her legs, past her privates and stomach and tits to her face. Her face, which was, to Buddy's fucked up senses, so very, very far away, but so easy to read.
Playtime's over.
Look, the face said out loud. We've had some laughs, right? Played a few songs, smoked some smokes. But you've turned out to be kind of a boring date, and I've got business to take care of. So why don't you tell me where the drugs are, or I'm going to have to start rubbing salt in your wounds. And I do mean that. Well, this is it, then, isn't it? Buddy thought. I'm just about dead, aren't I? He should have listened to Paris, he admonished himself. Yeah. Paris had never amounted to much, just a guy working the counter of a 24/7 mart. But he'd been right. Right about Alf. Right about the trouble you can get into ripping off the property of urban drug lords. That Paris was a bright guy, scrappy for all his fault. And Buddy was sure now of what he'd only somewhat believed before. Paris could find a way out of this fix. Paris would know what to do. If he could just talk to Paris. Paris. Bryce saw what was left of Buddy's lips flutter. She went down on a knee, put the side of her head to his mouth.
Paris? What about Paris? She asked.
His answer rode a slight voice up to her ear.
Paris is your roommate? What the hell kind of name is Paris? Where's this guy?
The voice was diminished beyond a whisper.
Which 24/7 mart?
And then the slight voice was almost gone.
I guess I'm going to have a little talk with your man Paris. Well, buddy boy, looks like we're all done with each other. Now this is what I want you to do. I want you to lay there with your eyes closed. That's all. Just lay there. And don't open your eyes or you'll ruin the surprise.
Buddy closed his eyes, closed his one eye that wasn't swollen shut. As crazy as everything was, the world got even scarier in the self-imposed dark. Buddy began to mumble. The radio went off, and the scary world got scarier still. Buddy mumbled more, louder. Please don't kill me. Please. Please don't.
Eyes closed. Don't spoil the surprise.
Just the sounds of timberlands walking over the wood floor. Then nothing. Only quiet. Terror reached fever pitch.
Don't. Don't kill me. Oh, God.
Only the quiet. Only the quiet. Buddy kept his eyes closed. Was it 5 minutes? 20? 15 seconds? It was impossible to tell, except that it felt like forever, and struggle as he might, that was as long as he could lie in the dark and quiet. Buddy, eyes open. Above him, Bryce, gun in hand. Bryce said,
"Surprise!"
The gun said, "Bang!" Marcus worked his Audi through traffic, toward the Fairfax district. Jay sat next to him, just about glowing.
That was so...
Jay was so excited, the only word he could think of to describe their little adventure thus far was...
Exciting. That was so... I've never done anything like it. Letting him think we're federal agents?
It's just bullshit. That's what we do for a living. We bullshit the artists, bullshit the label, then we sell the bullshit to the public. That 24/7 mark guy? Just bullshitting someone else for a change.
And you... You were so cool.
Jay couldn't help looking Marcus up and down.
So tough.
Marcus just drove. Jay watched him drive. Watched him very intently. Marcus felt himself getting watched. What? What are you looking at?
Nothing, I... Nothing.
Catching an address as they rolled, same as the one Mr. Bashir had sweated over to them back at the 24/7 mart, Marcus nodded at an apartment house, said, Here it is. He angled for the curb, parked the Audi. Up and out. Jay was at his side as Marcus went for the door. Marcus said, Man, I don't need this. Running all over town looking for some music. I signed up to be an agent, not captain of the tape retrieval unit. Jay didn't say anything to that. Jay was too busy giving Marcus the heavy stare again.
What the hell are you looking at?
Quick sheepish, Jay looked away, rang the doorbell. Bryce had her piece ready before the bell even stopped sounding. She was pretty sure it wasn't cops. Cops don't ring bells. Cops bust down doors. And this was L.A. L.A. cops are just as happy to shoot through a door as expend energy slamming their fat asses against it. Most likely, Bryce figured, it was a neighbor who'd heard her put a bullet in Buddy. She probably shouldn't have shot him. A bludgeoning or a strangulation is quieter, not to mention just taking a kitchen knife to a guy. Although, don't get the job done fast enough, and knifed-up people can get crazy with their screaming. It's surprising how many jabs with a sharp object the human body can take. Bryce knew. Bryce had counted. So she'd shot Buddy, and what's done is done. And if one of his neighbors wasn't street smart enough to keep to himself when he hears a gunshot, well, this was one of those jobs where sometimes you just had to do a couple of extra things gratis. The doorbell rang again. Bryce went to answer it. Jay kept ringing the doorbell. It gave him something to do, something besides looking at Marcus one more time. Jay said,
I don't think anyone's here.
Marcus eyed the duplex. It looked nothing but quiet. Heading around the side of the building. I'll check a window. Bryce pressed herself against the door, put an eye to the peephole. There was Jay, his jolly face, fisheye distorted. Didn't look like a neighbor. That suit? Salesman. Jehovah's Witness? Far as Bryce was concerned, what he was a sack of flesh waiting to become unalive. Bryce put her hand to the knob, ready to fling the door open, ready to yank Jay inside, ready to lay out another body next to Buddy's. The window. It rattled and pulled against its lock. Fat-faced suit guy wasn't alone. Blinds drawn, she couldn't see if it was another fatty or whether guy number two had a look all his own. Bryce shook her head. Killing a guy is one thing. Killing an extra somebody who stumbled along is another. With 3 bodies in 10 minutes, all of a sudden she's Chuck Manson. Again, the bell rang. And again. Bryce wanted to pop fat-faced suit guy just for being annoying. Fuck it, she thought. Standing around plugging strangers didn't get her any closer to Damon's drugs. Back of the apartment, another window that opened on an alley. Bryce made for it, stepping over the pile of Buddy as she went. Marcus came around from the side of the house. Jay kept ringing the bell.
No one's answering.
Windows locked, shades are drawn.
Maybe he's hiding.
He rang the bell again.
Hiding from who?
How's he going to know we're looking for him?
Well, so what do we do? Wait.
You can wait if you want to. I haven't even had breakfast yet. Marcus was already heading for the Audi. Like a little puppy dog, Jay trailed right behind. Paris blew quick into the 24/7 mart, like a guy who had places to be, like a guy who was late for an appointment to collect $1 million cash. He talked just as fast.
Mr. Bashir, I hate to tell you this. Actually, I don't hate to tell you, but I'm quitting. And that's nothing against you, 'cause you've always been do right by me. But it's time for me to get up out of here.
Bashir was filled with nothing but lamentation.
Are things that badly for you? They're not bad at all. It's all good.
Bashir took that, same as a knife to the heart.
Oh, my boy, there is no need to hide the truth from me. I know what it is like to be hunted.
One word out of Bashir's little roll jumped up and slapped Paris.
What are you? In my country, killing certain animals just to put food on one's table is enough to put a price on a man's head.
Wait. What do you mean, hunted?
They came here looking for you.
They? Who they?
Two men, a black man such as yourself, and another who was white, such angry men.
But who?
They did not say, not really. They were, I don't know, they were...
Agents?
Yes. That is what they said they were. They said they were agents.
Beneath Paris's blackness, he was white with panic. His head snapped side to side, doing a swift visual recon for any sign of the two guys sent after him.
Where are they? I do not know. Threats were made, Paris. There was nothing I was able to do.
Where are they?
I was compelled to tell them your address.
Jesus, the tape.
I am sorry. They forced me to tell them where you lived. You understand, do you not? Such evil, cruel men. I do not know to what lengths they would go in order to locate you.
Paris blew quick out of the 24/7 mart, like a guy who had some place to be. Like a guy who was about to have $1 million yanked out of his pocket.
Beware them!
Bashir yelled at the swinging door.
Beware them!
It was strange. Paris and Buddy had never been much more than roommates. Never been much more than two guys who split the rent. Buddy's initial relation to Paris was that he was a friend of Paris's old roommate, who had gone back to Wisconsin when he was good and fed the fuck up with L.A., letting Buddy move into the space. It was strange. Buddy and Paris shared a roof, but little, if anything, beyond that. They didn't share off hours together, or interests, and they very sure didn't share much of themselves. It was just two guys who occasionally occupied the same space at the same time. Paris couldn't tell you with certainty what Buddy did to earn his keep, or what he wanted to do, if they had been grace of God lucky enough to live in a world where people actually got to do what made them happy in life. Paris didn't know, except for Alfonso, any of Buddy's friends. If the rest of Buddy's friends were like Alf, then Paris didn't care to know them. What his favorite food was, the name of the last girl he'd laid, anything that passed for a hobby. None of that did Paris know concerning his roommate. It was strange, then, that the body of this guy who was a foreigner to him, Paris should be cuddling so tightly on the floor of their apartment. Paris didn't remember dropping down and wrapping up the carcass in his arms. Racing the gremlin from the 24/7 mart to the apartment, he recalled. He could remember opening the door, too. Then there was a haze. The place a mess. The stink of gunpowder. Buddy, who looked like he was sleeping, except for the purple and black defect smashed into the center of his forehead, some cuts, and a whole lot of burns. He looked like he was sleeping. That was it. Right then, that was when Paris ran to the body, took it in his arms, started bawling for the poor slob who'd never amounted to anything, and now never would. That Paris could find it in himself to cry for a person known yet unknown, that was the most strange of all. And while he was crying, while he was rocking his dead roomie, Paris started remembering some other things. He remembered Mr. Bashir yelling after him as he ran from the 24/7 mart. "Evil, cruel men," he had said. "Beware them," he had screamed. And something else came back to Paris. The agent. That Bayless guy. "Cut your heart out. Put my foot on your throat. Hear that sound? That's your neck snapping." Just a lot of talk. Just hot air from a pissed-off suit. That's what Paris had thought at the time. With a fresh dead body in his arms, Paris had to think again. Maybe they weren't just words. Maybe this Bayless guy wasn't just talk. He was an agent, wasn't he? What was the word on the street about Hollywood agents? The word Paris's actor and singer and writer friends passed on to him. The word was, agents were scum of the earth. Rattlesnakes in a preschool were more innocuous. In this part of the world, when you said agent, the associated phrases were, rough bastards, backstabbing assholes, vindictive motherfuckers who'd slit your throat then sell your blood to cover their expenses. That's if they didn't just drink it. Very quickly, Paris got to thinking there was more to that talk than just euphemisms and exaggerations. Very fast, he got to wondering what was to keep agents from truly stabbing backs and slitting throats. People killed for pocket change, Air Jordans. They killed because they got the wrong look from the wrong guy while stuck in traffic on the 405. So for the last of Ian, for a tape that was worth how many tens or hundreds of millions, what would a Hollywood agent do for that? Shifting Buddy in his arms, the trapdoor-like flap, with a bullet, had pushed his brains from his skull, squished against Paris's forearm. He began to think on what he should... They're still here. Finally and suddenly, the idea that whoever did the killing might still be around to do more came to Paris. He scrambled to his feet, dropping Buddy's carcass. Its thought-free head smacked against the wood, knocking more brains onto the floor like catsup whacked from a bottle. Paris listened hard, strained to hear the unseen killer over his thud, thud, thudding heart. He thought he should go for the door, get out of the apartment. But his body, weighted with fear, disobeyed him. So he stood, frozen, a perfect target. A while passed, but the invisible killer never came from one of the other rooms to put a bullet in Paris. After a while more, Paris finally realized the invisible killer in the apartment wasn't in the apartment. He was safe. And just then, Paris came up with a new thought. He'll come back. Him, them, they. The army of foot soldiers who marched up and down Wilshire Boulevard Bayless had sent to repo the tape by any means necessary. It was just a matter of time before they once again came for Paris. Paris went fast to the bedroom. Arm under the bed, he grabbed out the duffel. The tape was still as good as a check waiting to get cashed. If the killers, hadn't found it. Paris felt a lot of air as he fumbled a hand around the inside of the bag. A lot of air and... What the hell is that? A package wrapped in brown paper. Where the fuck's the... The tape, still there. Paris tossed the tape back into the duffel bag, and with it went some jeans, some t-shirts, some hope, and a little possibility. because that's all he was riding on now. Second chances. Closing it up, Paris threw the duffel over his shoulder and moved lickety-split for the door. He stopped. The faceless assassins could be watching the door. Worse, they could be on their way in as he was on his way out. Paris didn't much want to die by virtue of a fluke in timing. A back window. That was the way to go. Paris turned and moved fast for the new exit. He stopped. He went back to the living room. Back to Buddy's body. "I'm sorry, man," he said to his ex-roommate. This is all my fault. It's my fault, and I'm going to put it to them," Paris swore. "I'm going to screw that bastard Bayless. I'm going to..." Paris's revenge-fueled bravado was doused by a quick wave of fear. The more time he spent apologizing and vowing to dead Buddy, the more chance there was he would end up like dead Buddy. His mea culpa aborted, Paris shot out of the bedroom window without looking back. The Ralphs, south on La Brea, north of 3rd. It was just far enough away from the Fairfax district that Paris felt safe pulling over the Gremlin, dropping change in a slot and dialing some numbers without being picked up by the watchful eyes of the hit squad sent to eradicate him by
"Chad Bayless's office,"
the skirt on the other end of the phone said.
"Put him on."
"I'm sorry,"
the secretary came back with.
"Your name is?"
"Put him on the phone."
"I'll need your..."
"You put him on this fucking second."
Paris jammed his words into the woman's ear.
"Put him on the fucking phone."
Paris's anger was wasted on Jen. 8 months on the job, and she was well used to the vitriol spat at her by stars and stars' managers and hotshot record producers concerning life and death situations, like a limo being late, the wrong hors d'oeuvres being served at after-concert parties. Worse yet, the wrong whores being sent to a hotel room. Oh, the kind of screams that came with that. So one more person calling, ripping her a new ass to put fucking Chad on the fucking phone that fucking instant. Whip a dog long enough, it learns to take it. Jen buzzed her boss. Chad's coked-up brain collected itself enough to manage a hand over to the phone.
"Chad, there's a guy calling. He sounds very upset."
Chad's hearing was slurred. He had to fight to understand the woman in the next room. She went on.
"He wouldn't give his name, but I think it's the same guy who called this morning."
To himself. They must have found him. Chad snatched up the phone, high now, not only on the drugs, but also on his ability to send his minions marching into the sprawl of L.A. and have them return, mission accomplished. "You know what they call guys who could do that in this town?" Chad asked of himself.
"Honchos," he answered.
Yeah, that's what he was. He felt warm where he'd just hung a medal on his own chest. Into the phone.
"Hey, you little prick. You like the way my boys play?"
Paris didn't know what he'd expected from Bayless. Anger, maybe. Maybe rage. But this? Glee? You read about guys who killed and were happy for it. Guys who killed for the kick of killing. Media tag catchy named guys. The night stalker, the highway killer, the hillside strangler. There were drifters, wanderers, degenerates you'd figure to find trying to hitch rides with a 10 at the 15. Hair buzz cut, three state killing spree short. Ready to get down to the serious business of hacking up young boys and prostitutes. Where you wouldn't figure to find happy psychos is in the business district of Beverly Hills. Or maybe not. Maybe that's exactly where you find them. Maybe Hollywood, USA was a breeding ground for nut jobs. Maybe Paris just didn't know the business of show that good.
"Why did you do this?"
Paris asked. And asked again.
"Why?" Because it's my tape, that's why. Because you think you can fuck with me, and you need to get learned. You're nothing, you know that? You're a goddamn bug under my shoe.
The heat, the noise of the city, the whole environment of Los Angeles pressed on Paris, tried to squeeze the life from him. It had worked its slow kill on him every day of every year since he'd taken that hour drive up to L.A., moved up to the city to be something besides just a kid from Irvine. Years later, Paris wasn't a kid anymore. That's all about him that had changed, and the toll the city of his dreams had taken on him was just now reaching critical mass, just now readying a death blow.
You sick son of a bitch!
People in the parking lot turned, stared at Paris. It was a hell of a yell he put together that Angelinos should bother to notice him. He yelled on.
I'm going to the cops. I'm telling them everything.
Cops. That one word barbed wire caught in Chad's ear and tore loose a flood of bad thoughts. Investigation. Embezzlement. Drug buys. Cops. Jesus Christ, what the hell did Marcus and Jay do to the kid? He just told them to get the tape back, that's all. Just get back the tape. Maybe he had said it a little harsh, but that was just a way of expressing the seriousness of the situation. He didn't mean for them to... Had he told them to hurt the kid? The cocaine made things so very hard to remember. He didn't say hurt the kid, did he? He didn't tell them to get the tape back, even if they had to... Chad went girly with himself. The honcho medal slid right off his chest.
Wait. The police, asshole! What do you think? You could get away with this?
You don't... There doesn't have to be any police involved.
It's a little too fucking late for that. I swear to God, I'm putting you away. You're never gonna see this tape.
Listen to me.
Never! You listen to me!
Chad came back strong, words blowing over Paris like they were riding a steamroller.
You stole that tape. You're the one who stole it, and you're the one who tried to extort money. Who do you think the cops are going to believe, me or a piece of street trash like you? Go on,
Chad bluffed.
Go call the police. Money talks, and I've got enough to scream for days. You're fucked, you little bastard, good as dead. I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you, and I'm going to kick...
Chad's voice was cut off, dichotomized by Paris's slamming the phone down into the cradle. All strength trickled from Paris, so that he didn't as much hold onto the phone as use it to hold himself up. Then came the question asking as Paris cross-examined himself, like a 2-yard-an-hour shyster who was getting all indignant for the cameras on Court TV.
How?
How does a guy end up where he is? How does a guy get to a place where some Hollywood suit he didn't even know a full day before was now making hunting him down job one, top priority, with no skimping on expenses. And he would come after him, Paris thought. From where Paris saw things, Chad's thugs had already drawn a bead on him once, barely missing, and leaving a body in their wake as a consolation prize. That was just for warm-ups.
How?
How does a guy who's wanted dead stay alive? His hand on the phone, the keypad just beneath him. 10 digits, starting out with the 714 area code. Orange County, Irvine. That's how a guy gets out of things. That's how Paris had gotten out of things in the past. That's how he had helped himself when rent was due and nowhere to be found. When the insurance company was coming around looking for payments to keep the gremlin covered. 10 digits, starting out with the 714 area code. Orange County, Irvine, Mom and Dad. It wasn't like Paris wanted to call them every time cash was short, or a loan needed to be co-signed, or a car was stuck in impound until tickets were paid. It wasn't like Paris hadn't tried to make it on his own, He tried as best he knew how to get over with some bit of slickness that had to do with music or videos or singing or acting, none of which, admittedly, he had worked at very hard or done very well. But regardless of talent or brains, you were supposed to come to L.A. and surf a slithery and smooth and superficial wave to a state of perfunctory idol worship, big money, and loose women. Everything about this town told you that was the way it was supposed to be, from the movies it made to the daily propaganda it spewed on Entertainment Tonight. That was the problem, the town itself. This fucking town, seemingly fertile for accomplishment, yet inimical to success. Hollywood and her tramp sisters' fame and fortune were nothing but a bunch of whore seducers. With a smile and a wink and a wiggle of the ass, they shanghaied you over to some dark corner where their brothers, the twin goons Despair and Defeat, waited to come at you, bearing all the pleasantries of a back-alley abortion. That's when you got what the town really had waiting for you. The pounding of a lifetime. Just for thinking you could get a little of what the city had to offer. In Hollywood, in the land of entertainment, beating the little guy into bloody submission was entertainment. And the body cooling back at the apartment made Paris think Chad was an impresario. 10 digits. Starting out with the 714 area code. Mom and Dad would make everything all right. Didn't they always? Paris wanted to know of himself. When you were the only black kid on the block, when the white kids called you Jig and Coon in the same breath they called the kids with glasses Four Eyes, and the fat kid Lard Ass, didn't Mom and Dad do something or other and make everything okay? When you were in high school, going on a junior, mind you, weighing in at 135 pounds, and there were freshmen who wanted to kick the living shit out of you, didn't Mom and Dad come to the rescue? There had always been a stopgap, a safety net. There had always been a fallback. There had always been them, and as long as there had been them, Paris never once was required to do the extra little bit of whatever it takes to sneak across the border separating the no-ones from the some-ones. It had been that way, through grade school and through high school, and through college, and through life. And the high-priced shyster stepped in, took over, made an angry accusation for summation, and maybe, if you hadn't gone running to Mommy and Daddy, that hurt, for help back then, you wouldn't be running to them for help every time the sky gets partly cloudy or a dog shits on your doorstep. Maybe if you hadn't cowered behind them like some Charles Atlas sissy fag, dodging the sand flying at his face, then you wouldn't be standing in a parking lot talking to yourself now. And maybe it's all just like Kayla had pointed out, so simply and precisely. Maybe, Paris Scott, you are nothing but a loser. Paris thought about all that for a sec. Then he thought about the alternative. Maybe he had been a loser. Okay, not much doubting that. But maybe there was still time for redemption. If he could somehow get out of this, get out of this stolen property, suicide, murder turmoil, and do it on his own, without dialing those 10 digits. Didn't that amount to something? Something more, at least, than trying to book acts into Sunset Boulevard clubs for 10% of nothing, or whatever other entry-level Hollywood bullshit he'd spent the last bunch of years trying to perpetrate. If he could extricate himself from all this death, chaos, mayhem, and money lust, then just let Kayla try and call him a loser. Just let her. Paris took his hand from the phone. He spent about half a second coming up with an obvious front-of-the-shelf plan. Put as much space as he could between himself and Hollywood, and the people in Hollywood who wanted him dead. get out of town, get some money, then get more out of town. The tape, the last of Ian, had to be converted from commodity to cash, quick cash. It could be done, but it would take some illegal below-the-table double-dealing, the exchange of stolen goods for loose money without the bothersome question-asking of the right-minded. There was only one place on Earth, one other place, Paris knew of, where that kind of behavior was not only accepted, but encouraged. Fortunately, it was just a 4-hour drive away. Paris made for the Gremlin. Mr. Bashir was working the counter when Bryce walked in. Other than the old Russian woman who had survived Zagrodsky and a Mexican who had survived a dash across the border, the 24/7 mart was empty. Had the USC marching band been in the middle of a bare naked fuckfest next to the Tasty Freeze, Bryce still would have got the notice from Mr. Bashir. As it was, she received his full and complete attention.
"You the manager?" Bryce asked.
"Yes, ma'am."
Bashir smiled, big and broad, like a guy who made his living from a service job and knew that smiling at the customer is what got you paid. The fact that the customer looked as fine as Bryce did didn't hurt his smile in the least.
"What is it I may help you with?"
"I'm looking for someone. Paris? He around?"
"Oh, God in heaven."
Small shakes from Mr. Bashir's head.
"Not again. What is it that he has done this time?"
"He's been a bad boy. A very bad boy."
Bryce wore a little sneer whose edge carried a sharp force impact.
"I do not understand what has happened to him. Paris has been such a fine employee."
"Yeah, well, you have to be careful. People are a strange animal. Never know which way they're going to jump from one minute to the next. Know what I'm saying?"
"I most certainly do. There was a time when a man I once called a friend borrowed from me a..."
Not caring anything for Bashir's story.
"Know where I can find my man, Paris?"
"I don't. I'm not..."
Mr. Bashir hemmed and hawed, having already given up more information on an employee than an employer should have to in a string of months, let alone one day.
"You know something? You're not a bad-looking guy."
Bryce couldn't have been any more offhanded with the remark. Still, any kind of come-on from her didn't much help Bashir get over his stammering. She leaned to him across the counter. Not a drop of perfume on her body, and still, she smelled good.
"You know that? Huh. You're not bad-looking."
"I... thank you."
Bryce got with a curious look.
"Where are you from? India?"
"Pakistan."
"Pakistan? Yeah. I've never been with a Pakistan guy before."
Bryce floated her way through the partition, floated herself right up to Bashir, who backed from her all-consuming presence, only to run up against the far side of the counter. With nowhere to go, Mr. Bashir's body went flush against Bryce.
"What do you Pakistan guys got?" she asked.
To answer her own question, Bryce's hand snaked down to Bashir's groin. Mr. Bashir was uncomfortable, to say the least, about having a strange woman fondle his privates behind the counter, while an old Russian woman and a Mexican did their shopping. Never minding that, Bashir went steel rail hard.
"Miss, please.
Come on. We're all big kids."
Bryce's hand found Mr. Bashir's zipper. Bashir's zipper went down. Bryce's hand went in. Bryce got herself a grip full of meat, presently surprised by the quantity.
"Yeah, I think I like Pakistan guys."
Mr. Bashir's eyes closed, his head tilted back at the end of a shiver that ran his spine. Bryce, close, lips to Bashir's ear.
I have to find Paris.
The little waves of excitement that sparked and popped in Bashir's body made concentrating, talking, as easy as climbing a mountain.
I do not know where he is. I think that perhaps he is in hiding.
Oh, that's no good. You suppose he might call you?
Bryce's hand squeezed and stroked.
If he does, would you call me?
Squeeze. Stroke. Orgasmic.
Yes!
Man, you're so good.
Bryce's tongue lapped Bashir's ear. From the counter, she took a Sharpie, put it to Bashir's chest, and wrote a phone number. She said,
"Call me."
Done, Bryce withdrew her hand and slipped from the mart, brushing past the old Russian woman, who approached the counter with a carton of milk. With his customer-comes-first smile, Mr. Bashir said,
"Yes, Mrs. Litvak, will that be all?"
He said it normal. Normal like a guy who didn't have a chick's number tattooed on him, or his cock flapping from his zipper hole.
I think I scared him away.
Across the distance, over the digital PCS, through his cell phone on a crystal clear connection, Marcus could feel the wet of Chad's tear-soaked words.
"What did you tell him?" Marcus asked.
"I told him I was going to find him and kill him."
"Yeah, well, threat of death is the kind of thing that tends to scare people off."
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare him."
Chad went into a near, full-on breakdown. With every sob, Marcus heard the spray of mucus from Chad's nose. It made Marcus regret the sarcasm he'd thrown out a moment prior.
"Okay, man, just be cool. We're gonna find the tape, all right? We'll find it."
Marcus closed up his phone, stared at it, shook his head, then tossed the phone on the dashboard.
"Damn, that boy is tore up."
"Jay."
"What happened?"
"He scared off the kid. Told him we were gonna come looking for him. We were gonna kill him."
Jay went playfully buoyant.
"Ooh, I'm a killer."
"Now he's gone underground and we've got to find him before Chad pops a vein."
"Sure, 8 million people in L.A. and we've got to find this one guy? We ought to be home in time for Ellen on Lifetime."
"He's not in the city."
"Oh, then we just have to search the entire state. What's another half hour of work?"
Marcus slipped out a picture from the inside pocket of his jacket. The picture of Paris and the girl, next to the Vegas sign. He handed it over to Jay. Jay asked,
"What?"
"Look at the picture."
Jay looked.
"Vegas?"
"That's where he's heading."
"You think?"
"If somebody was going to rock your world, what would you do? Where would you hide but someplace you felt safe? Look at him."
Second time, Jay looked at Paris, snapshotted for eternity at the very south end of the strip. Marcus gave running commentary. "Look at him, smiling and all happy. He feels good there. He feels safe.
Vegas." "But he doesn't really think we're going to hurt him."
Flipping up his hands in a non-committal gesture.
"Hey, I don't know what he thinks. Not for sure. But I can put myself in his place. I can crawl around in his head. I'm a frightened street punk. I've got something I shouldn't have. I've got some asshole on the phone talking about how he's going to help my hide. Yeah, I tell you what I do. I get the fuck out of Dodge, sell whatever contraband I was carrying, then go underground for a long time. We intercept him in Las Vegas, or not at all. Marcus had explained things clear and reasoned, like at some point, somehow, Paris had let the assistant in on exactly what his plans for squeezing out of a jam were. And Jay had listened to Marcus in pure rapture, not as if his partner was breaking down the psychology of a terrified mind on the run, but like he was watching Jesus himself doing water wine tricks at a sold-out show.
Wow! It is so amazing you can figure that out. All you did was look at a picture, and you...
That old flushed feeling was coming back to Jay.
You knew everything.
Marcus shrugged. Nothing special about it. While he talked, he thought, at this time of day, what's the best way to get to the 10? You use your head, you use your gut, listen to what they've got to say. They'll tell you how to handle things. You know what it's about?
What's about?
In the middle of a preach, Marcus missed Jay's question to his question and just went on sermonizing. It's about how you approach a situation. It's about attitude.
What do you mean?
Bridgeport.
That a shoe?
Part of Chicago. Ethnic. Ethnic meaning Irish and Polish and Italian and anything else that isn't black. That's the way it's always been. And that's the way you best believe they're trying to keep it. Those Irish and Italians and whatnot are serious black people haters. Make the Klan look like Girl Scouts doing laundry. You know what I mean? People who hated people for no good reason except just because people who hated people who were different.
Yeah, Jay said. I know what you mean.
One time when I was a kid in my teens, I was walking along Lakeshore Drive. I'm from Chicago, did you know that?
No.
So I'm walking along Lakeshore Drive, the Gold Coast, at night. And this cop rolls up to me, asks me what I'm doing in this part of town at night. This part of town. Like that part of town couldn't be my part of town, which it was. My parents did okay. We had a place near the lake. Not too much. Same as most middle-class families. But the cop didn't see that. Didn't know that. Didn't want to hear anything about all that. All the cop cared about was a black kid walking at night in this part of town. Prejudice. Bigotry.
Go on,
Jay prompted, hoping the story would end with the cop's comeuppance. So I tell the cop, this is where I live, and I have every right to walk where I want. Now I can tell he doesn't care for my way of talking to him at all, and I don't care that he doesn't care. So the cop tells me to get in the squad, talking about he's going to give me a ride home, and I had better live where I say I do. I get in and he drives. Only he doesn't take me home. He takes me to Bridgeport. Irish, Polish, Italian. Black people hating Bridgeport. The cop opens the door and kicks me out. The cop's all smug with himself. Says something smart like I should see if I have every right to walk where I want now. Then drives off. Just leaves me there. A black kid. Middle of the night. Bridgeport.
Jesus.
Jay, campfire ghost story hung on every word.
What happened?
I started walking. I knew that was the only way I was going to get home.
But weren't you afraid you were going to get roughed up?
Hell, I knew I was going to get beat. Probably, if I was lucky, to an inch of my life and no more. Couldn't run, couldn't hide. Nothing I could do to stop it. So I got it in my head, if I'm going to get beat, Then I'm going to give some beaten back, too. I'm going to give back as much as I can. I started thinking, if somebody messes with me, well, then I'm going to kill them. Not hurt. Kill. And I wore that on my face. Tacked it up like a neon sign. Start something, you die. I hadn't made as much as a mile when I came on three white guys about my age and twice my size. I didn't know if they were Poles or Italians or what, but I could tell they were drunk. Of course they were drunk. You live in Bridgeport. What else is there to do with your life but drink and beat your wife? And these three were too young to be married. The three of them, they eyed me fast and made my way, ready to do some pounding. By itself, of its own free will, Jay's hand rubbed back and forth on his leg, working its way from outer thigh to inner. So then what? Then nothing. They saw my look. They read the sign. Start something, you die. They saw I meant it. They could smell kill or be killed drifting off of me. Sure, I couldn't take all three of them. One might have gotten away with a nick, another one some bruises and cuts, but one of them was going to die, and none of them wanted to be that guy. They believed it. I made them believe it. And those three white boys went back to their corner, went back to their drinking, were probably still drinking when I finally got home a few hours later. Straight down Fairfax, Marcus figured. That's the best way to catch the 10. As a coda to the tale, he offered. Probably still there drinking their lives away now. Story over, Jay became self-aware and jerked his hand away from himself.